Good afternoon, 103. I hope you're having a good day. I'm recording these things over the summer. I don't know if you've noticed outside, it's been very cloudy, not exactly a warm summer. You're probably watching this, it's probably October or something like that, October, early November. Might even be warmer right now than it is as I'm recording this. Anyway, that's your weather report for this time. We're in chapter 9. Chapter 9 finishes the model. So it takes our assumptions about consumer behavior. It takes our assumptions about firms, puts them all together, and we finally generate a supply and demand model. And in chapter 10, we're just going to be using this model over and over again. One little thing I want you to note, and you know, maybe you're going to never take another econ class in your life. And what are you going to take away from this course? And maybe here's something that you could take away from it. So in chapter six, we had this sort of a model where we had a downward sloping market demand curve, but our market supply curve was fixed. It was just, there was no production. It was an endowment. Might think that's a kind of limiting model, but it turns out there's lots of things in life for which this is kind of approximately true, where supply is fixed. So if you think of like the housing market in Vancouver, it's true that as price goes up, people will build more houses, but the flow of housing is so small relative to the big stock of housing that we can think of the stock of housing or the supply of housing as essentially fixed. And in a model like this, you know, when demand curve shifts up or demand curve shifts down, what happens is you get a change in price, but you get no change in the quantity that's being produced or supplied because the supply is fixed. In chapter 9, you saw that another extreme case for supply is that supply might be completely elastic. This happens when firms are essentially identical. You're using identical inputs, identical technologies. And so what happens now when the demand curve shifts, you get no change in price. Price is basically determined by the technology in the market. And all that happens is that you get changes in a quantity response. And again, there's lots of markets that are like this. And later on in the book, we're going to look at labor markets. Labor markets are often like this. Well, many labor markets are like this. If you're in a labor market where there's just hundreds of thousands of other people just like you, you know, you're in a labor market for physical things like lifting boxes. Well, all it takes is two arms and a back to lift a box, and there's lots of people that can do that. So again, you have changes in the demand for those kinds of laborers, and you get changes in employment, but you get no change in wage rates. Whereas in a labor market, this model over here might represent kind of a superstar model, or something. There's something about you, you're unique. There's only one human being that does what you do, and so changes in the demand for your services are directly converted to changes in your wage rate. But what we're going to do in chapter 10 is in chapter 10, we're mostly going to look at this general case. And in this general case, when demand increases, what happens is we'll observe an increase in price and there will be an increase in quantity. In the general case, supply curves are upward sloping, demand curves are downward sloping at the market level. A good example of this is that the beginning of the COVID crisis, we were told that we had to do lockdown, we had to flatten the curve because we were worried about hospital capacity. We didn't want to overrun the hospitals. We thought we were living in this world where hospital services were fixed. Generally speaking, though, we live in this world where the supply of hospital services is upward sloping. It turned out that we were pretty much living in this world, that it turned out you could increase the amount of emergency capacity to take care of COVID patients just by not allowing any other patients into the hospital. So every other emergency situation was considered non-essential immediately and freed up, you know, three times the amount of space in the hospital. Not only that, we found out you could convert football stadiums and hockey arenas and gymnasiums and all kinds of things to emergency intensive care units. And so we ended up in a world like this, which ironically meant in very few places did we ever come close to hindering the hospital capacity. Anyway, enough about that. Chapter 17 of chapter 9, question 17, has an issue that I just wanted to talk about. You'll notice there's probably about four or five questions in chapter 9 that have this nature, and there's probably four or five questions in chapter 10 that are about this, because I think it's a really important point. In the winter of 2012, the BC film industry went into a tailspin. Whereas at any given time during the past several years, there had been as many as 50 movies being shot on a given day, in January 2013, there were only four. Naturally, there are calls from those within the industry demanding that the provincial government increase subsidies and tax concessions. Here's the question. When an industry is said to be dying, what's usually meant is that firms in that industry have revenues that are less than costs. What do these costs represent according to the notion of opportunity costs? When a firm pays wages to its laborers, or it pays rent for its capital, why are these prices positive? What do those wages mean? Those wages are being determined in another market, right? These workers are productive in another market. At the margin, these workers are producing something of value that's equal to their wage rate per hour. And so if you're in a film industry and you're hiring people, those people are sacrificing output elsewhere. That's what it means. When you rent trucks and other kinds of equipment, this equipment can be used elsewhere and has value. And so costs to a firm really represent the value of those resources elsewhere. What is society giving up for this film to be made? Now, what are the revenues? The revenues of that firm, the revenues are equal to, you know, they're a measure of the revenue per unit, right, which is the price, is a measure of the marginal value. So you're saying, we're going to make one more film. The revenues of that film are a measure of the value, the social value of that marginal film. It costs something. That's a measure of how much society had to sacrifice to get that marginal film, right? And so when a firm is dying, or when an industry is dying, and that means that the revenues are less than costs, what that means is the value of the film that's being made is lower than the value of the other goods that we're sacrificing. Given your answer today to A, why is it socially good to let dying industries die? A dying industry means that it's sucking valuable things away to produce something of low value. That's a terrible thing, and we want that firm to be punished, and the way we punish that firm is that the owners of that firm have to bear the loss, and if they can't bear the loss, then they go out of business. But that's what we want them to do. We don't want firms around that are generating losses habitually, because what that means is they're destroying the wealth of the economy. And so every time you subsidize or give a tax concession, you're basically subsidizing the bad behavior. The bad behavior that's moving resources from valuable uses over to non-valuable uses. The reverse is true about profits. When somebody's making a profit, what is a profit? A profit is just the difference between the revenues of a firm and its opportunity costs. The revenues of the firm represent the value of the thing that is being produced. The costs represent the values elsewhere. So when a firm is making profits, what it means is that it's taking resources that are low, in a low productivity, they're in an activity where they have a low productivity, moving them to where they have a high productivity. moving things from low valued to high valued. That's a good thing. And the entrepreneur is rewarded by having a profit. And so we often think that people that are making high profits are bad because they're just adding on to costs. They're not adding on to costs. They're creating a difference between costs and revenues, which is value added to the economy. And that is a good thing. We should cheer the firm who makes profits. We should punish the firm that's making losses, even though for the individual who's making losses and has to go out of business, it's a bit of a tragedy, right? Sort of counterintuitive. The common sense notion of profits is you just something you add on to costs. Common sense thing about losses is, oh, we should help these poor people that are doing something. But that fails to recognize what do revenues mean really and what do costs mean. All right. Go through chapter 9 and 10 and see if you can find other questions that are just like that and see if you can come up with a similar answer. As always, have a great day. I'll talk to you next time.